All right, the second case today, Revell versus Morrison Supply Company, cause number 2-15195-CV. We have Brandy Austin arguing for appellant Revell, and we have Russell Wilson arguing for Morrison Supply Company. And you all are ready to proceed? All right, thank you. Ms. Austin.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent Terry Revell, appellant, and the primary issue for this court to decide is whether the trial court erred in granting summary judgment based on lack of standing in the personal injury case of plaintiff and appellant Terry Revell after his Chapter 13 bankruptcy was dismissed despite informal disclosure of the accident to the trustee, where the accident occurred post-petition and post-dismissal setting by the trustee. So the very small window of time. Appellant is requesting that the matter be reversed and remanded based on proportionality and equitability under the law. Okay, this case was should be reversed and remanded because Terry Revell did have standing to sue for his personal injury claims, and he filed his petition on April 14th, 2014. The Chapter 13 bankruptcy was filed in conjunction with his wife on December 5th, 2012. On February 14th, 2013, the trustee filed a motion to dismiss for failure to make the proposed payments and failure to timely file a confirmation plan. And Mr. Revell was actually injured on the job February 20th, about 6 days later. Mr. Revell's case was ultimately dismissed from the bankruptcy court on April 30th, with the trustee requesting the dismissal, and he was discharged from his duties on August 20th. The petition in this case, again, was filed April 14th, 2014. Ultimately, Mr. Revell received no benefit of the dismissed without prejudice Chapter 13 bankruptcy. He received no unfair advantage. The creditors were not harmed or disadvantaged in any way, and there was disclosure, although admittedly it wasn't formal amendment of the schedules of personal property. Mr. Revell never attempted to conceal the potential asset. In fact, they called the trustee, or his wife called the trustee and their attorney at the time. So standing and judicial estoppel are closely intertwined, and the courts usually do and should analyze the issues together in bankruptcy disclosure cases. This personal injury lawsuit was filed after the Chapter 13 bankruptcy was dismissed without prejudice. So that means that the creditors could immediately file a lawsuit against them. Appellee argued that Mr. Revell's lack of formal disclosure regarding a specific cause of action made the closed bankruptcy estate trustee the only remaining person that had standing to sue. And that's not the case based on recent case law and Chapter 13 bankruptcies. Both parties agree that an appellant isn't judicially estopped because the court never accepted a contrary position. They never amended their schedules after the injuries. In fact, they never did anything other than contact everyone after the injuries occurred. So there's a major difference with Chapter 13 debtors. They remain in possession of the property unless there's a confirmed plan or an order confirming the plan. And the reason for that is because the creditors take their recovery from future earnings. And that's in the Harris v. Veglin case. And please excuse me if I don't pronounce them correctly. There were no payments made by Revell or his wife to the original proposed plan. And one of the reasons is because creditors objected multiple times to the proposed plan that was submitted. There was no confirmation, and the case was set by for dismissal by the trustee prior to the actual accident. And disclosure does not necessarily have to be strictly by amending the schedules of personal property. Schedules require the existence of an asset and evaluation of that asset. They just didn't know. what the value of a potential cause of action was. They didn't know the term cause of action. They were laypersons without legal knowledge, and cause of action is a term of art that we use in the legal field. Kristen Revel, the wife of Terry Revel, contacted the trustee shortly after the accident occurred. She explained to the trustee the accident, the injuries, the circumstances surrounding everything, and that he was not able to work anymore. So he couldn't make any payments, he couldn't do anything. He was injured, and he was injured permanently. So he's still not able to fully work like he used to. They had to, Appley argues that they needed to specifically state a cause of action. Well, it's an on-the-job injury, which means there could be different ways you can go. There's workers' comp, there's personal injury, there could be no insurance, which means there's not really a value. There was just so many unknowns at the time, but what they did know, they did relay to the trustee. The trustee has knowledge of injuries and accidents, and that those sometimes lead to lawsuits. And unlike other cases, specifically in Ray Boucher, which is a bankruptcy court case, this trustee didn't ask for any additional information. He specifically said, and I quote, "We have no sympathy for injuries," or "the bankruptcy court has no sympathy for injuries." So what are the disclosure requirements in similar situations like this? Because there's no bankruptcy code that specifically states, post-petition, no payments made, dismissal already set, not formally dismissed. So we look to Texas state cases that have discussed this issue. Now, it's been discussed in Ferguson versus Building Materials, which is a Texas Supreme Court case. This court addressed similar issues in Kilpatrick versus Kilpatrick. And in 2012, after Texas Supreme Court heard the Ferguson case, there was Norris v. Brookshire, which states, "Full disclosure is crucial to the integrity of the bankruptcy proceedings, but disclosure by means other than amending the schedule of personal property should be taken into consideration when the outcome of not doing so would be grossly disproportionate." And I cannot think of another case in which it would be grossly disproportionate, because Terry Revel is no longer able to work full time. He's permanently injured, and now there's no recovery. Okay, so this court ruled on Kilpatrick versus Kilpatrick in 2006. But Revel is actually distinguishable from Kilpatrick. And first, the asset in Kilpatrick existed prior to the bankruptcy filings. And in that case, the debtor actually filed three bankruptcies, and he failed to disclose a stock asset. He filed a Chapter 11, which was eventually converted to a Chapter 7 and discharged September 17, 1992. But when this court heard the case, in the opinion, someone noted that the case appeared to still be open and active, and there were things being processed. 5 years later, the debtor filed a Chapter 13 case on February 6, 1995. The case was dismissed on December 31st, 1995, which is sufficient time for confirmation and payments to the creditors, although the specifics of the bankruptcy weren't outlined in the actual opinion. 9 months after that, they filed another bankruptcy, dismissed that one, and that was filed September 27, 1996. And in 2003, 7 years later, coincidentally, the debtor amended his previous schedules, and the debtor received, he actually received a discharge on the Chapter 11, which was converted to a Chapter 7, which included the same undisclosed asset that the case was heard on. So there were several bankruptcies, several non-disclosures, and he didn't amend it until 2003, 7 years after the last bankruptcy. Also important to note on page 695 of that opinion, $56,879.29 was actually paid to the creditors. So there were payments made. There was a benefit received by the debtor. He was able to have a reduced debt by paying this amount. The Revels made no payments. They received no reduced debt. The creditors are still in the same position they were prior to filing the bankruptcy. So in Kilpatrick, this court relied on Kunica versus St. John Financial Incorporated for guidance on that decision. Well, Revel can be distinguished from that too. In that case, the debtor received a functional equivalent of a discharge, which means they received all the benefits of a bankruptcy without the actual final discharge. And it was a pre-petition asset, and it wasn't disclosed. Also, that case was a Chapter 11, not a Chapter 13. Chapter 11's for small business, Chapter 13 is personal debt. Both are reorganizations, but the role of a Chapter 13 trustee differs from a Chapter 11 and a Chapter 7 trustee, in that a Chapter 13 trustee is largely administrative. They review plans, they advise the court, the debtor, the creditor, and they act as a distributing agent, distributing payments to the creditors. conversely, as opposed to in Kunica, Revel now owes more money than he did at the time he originally filed. He received no benefits. The creditors had the immediate right to sue. And we are requesting that this court reverse and remand so that Revel will have the right to sue on his own behalf. So the bankruptcy was dismissed without prejudice. Under 11 U.S.C. 349, the effect of a dismissal, it states that the dismissal is that the court orders otherwise. A dismissal reverts the property of the estate in entirety in which such property was vested immediately before the commencement of the bankruptcy. Now here's where we run into our second problem. This was not an asset prior to the bankruptcy. This was a post-petition accident that occurred with an unknown cause of action and an unknown value. But if we look at Norris v. Brookshire, we see on page 231, they talk about the purpose of 11 U.S.C. 349. And the purpose is to revert as if the bankruptcy never occurred, which is exactly what we're asking the court to acknowledge today. There's no plain language in 349b3 that precludes the assertion of a claim for lack of disclosure when the case is dismissed. And that's also in Norris. And just to take it a step further, I did some internet research on other states' bankruptcies, Chapter 13, and I found in the Chapter 13 handbook for the trustee in Akron, Ohio, that states that if the Chapter 13 plan is dismissed, creditors may immediately continue with state court litigation pursuant to applicable state law. If a bankruptcy case is dismissed, the legal effect is that bankruptcy is deemed void. Void. Void is which, null and completely without force or binding effect, like it just didn't happen. Like everything that the entire bankruptcy completely wiped out. They also distinguish between a dismissal of a case where a potential made substantial compliance, made payments, had a confirmation plan. There's a difference. The point is that there is a difference between the effect of a dismissal with no benefit, where no benefit was received by the debtor, and if there was a benefit received by the debtor. Tara Revel received no benefit. Creditors were not disadvantaged in any way. They filed 5 objections to the original confirmation plan, trying to block approval of the confirmation plan. Appley brought up the fact that they didn't have the opportunity to convert to a Chapter 7. Well, there are very limited circumstances where you can convert to a Chapter 7. Not paying timely is one of them. They had ample time to do that. They didn't. And excuse me. And not getting a confirmation plan in time is also another way. These things happened prior to the accident. No one filed. Now, I think the confusion as to the standing of an undisclosed asset of a Chapter 13 debtor could potentially be cleared up, you know, with a test. So first, was there an impairment to the creditor's ability to collect the debts? This is discussed in Norris. and kind of discussed in Ferguson, where they asked, did debtors receive an unfair advantage? Number two, did the debtor act intentionally, not inadvertently, in failing to disclose? This is discussed in Horsley Layman.
We have water on the table if you'd just like to stop a second.
I only have like
one. Well, we'll let you go over just a little bit. I understand. It won't be your last.
Okay. Number two, did the debtor act intentionally, not inadvertently, in failing to disclose the assets? Now, this is discussed in cases where there are judicial estoppel issues, Ferguson and Horsley Layman. But in my opinion, those cases have to at least take standing into consideration. You can't have a suit, can't have subject matter jurisdiction if standing doesn't exist. But in this case, there was no concealment of the assets. Revel and his wife called everyone they knew to call and told them all the information they had available. It took 14 months for the personal injury attorney they hired to find the cause of action and file a lawsuit. And then the third part is, did the debtor receive any financial benefit of the bankruptcy? And this distinguishes, you know, Kilpatrick and Kunica and Norris and Ferguson. Because in Norris and Ferguson, there was no benefit. Kunica, they had a functional equivalent on a discharge. In Kilpatrick, $56,000 were already paid to the creditors. So there was a reduced amount technically owed. There was, the creditors were disadvantaged. So in conclusion, it's disproportionate and not at all equitable to apply the doctrine of standing or even judicial estoppel, for that matter, when a bankruptcy case gives the benefit to the debtor or impairs the creditor's rights to collect the outstanding debt. Appellee is seeking a windfall. There is no one to collect on this man's injuries. Permanent, debilitating, no longer able to work full-time, same job, injuries. Terry Revel has a part-time job and just wants to be compensated, or at least given the opportunity to allow a jury to award him what he feels he's rightfully owed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Austin. Mr. Wilson.
May it please the court, counsel. Today, this court has the opportunity to again affirm its commitment to the integrity of the judicial system, and in particular, the bankruptcy system that provides an opportunity for thousands each year to seek debt relief. The decision on this appeal and the opinion to follow may be one of the easiest for the court this year. And I say that because the real issues in this case have already been decided by this court. And the opinion to be written has essentially already been written. That opinion is Kilpatrick. Kilpatrick is dispositive of this appeal. The challenge for this court is to resist the equitable temptations and pleas of this unhappy plaintiff and decide this case on the rule of law that benefits the system as a whole. There are really two basic issues on this appeal. Number one, does a Chapter 13 debtor who fails to disclose a cause of action have standing to thereafter pursue a cause of action for his own benefit? This court has already said in Kilpatrick that the answer to that question is no. The second question is, did this plaintiff disclose to the bankruptcy court, the trustee, and his creditors this cause of action as required by law? The clear answer to that, again, is no. Despite the many disagreements that there may be in this case, there are a few things about which there is no disagreement. There's no dispute, and in fact, they are indisputable. One, this cause of action that we're talking about here today was part of the bankruptcy estate prior to dismissal. Undisputed, indisputable. The law imposed upon the plaintiff an obligation to schedule and disclose statutorily this cause of action in his bankruptcy. Didn't do so. That is undisputed. There is no dispute that no schedule was filed. There was nothing in writing to alert the trustee, the bankruptcy court, or the creditors of this cause of action. Because even the plaintiff appreciates the importance of the disclosure requirements in a bankruptcy, I mean, it is the foundation of the bankruptcy system, they're scrambling, trying to find an explanation as to why they didn't disclose. And in doing so, they create a little bit of an inconsistency. On the one hand, they say, we didn't know about it, therefore we couldn't and didn't disclose it. On the other hand, they say, well, we did disclose it to the trustee when my wife called and said, I've been in an accident, I've been hurt, we can't make payments. The gist of that is what this plaintiff is asking this court to do is ignore the bankruptcy rules, the statutory written disclosure requirements, and instead find statutory disclosure is met when a wife calls the trustee and said, I've been in an accident. And then from there, speculate as to what the wife actually said, speculate as to how the trustee interpreted that, speculate as to whether or not the trustee wrangled those facts together and concluded that there might be some cause of action, and then impose a burden on the bankruptcy court and the creditors to go to the trustee and say, oh, by the way, are there any assets out there that you know about that haven't been scheduled as required by law? That's why the statutory sworn written disclosure rules exist, so everybody knows. There's no guessing, speculating, hypothecating, investigation. It's either disclosed or it's not. In this case, that's not a fact issue. And in fact, the conclusive evidence is that this plaintiff knew enough to know that he might have a cause of action. His wife and he talked about it. They felt like Morrison Supply was responsible for it, and they hired a personal injury lawyer to pursue it. It is undisputed that plaintiff knew enough to suggest he might have a cause of action. And this court, in the Horsley Layman opinion, specifically said that imposes him an obligation to disclose it regardless of whether he knew the legal basis for the claim. In that same opinion, this court, through Justice Livingston, made it very clear and acknowledged that confusion as to what must be disclosed does not create a fact issue, and even negligent non-disclosure does not create a fact issue. By failing to disclose that cause of action, he represented the creditors that it didn't exist. This plaintiff knew enough to suggest he might have a cause of action. The law required that he disclose that, and he didn't. That's not a fact issue.
Given that the case was dismissed, how were the creditors disadvantaged?
That is not an issue in a standing case.
But that's my question.
I don't know that they were, but the creditors were not given an opportunity to address this cause of action. That may have provided them some benefit. They could have made the decision, the trustee could have made the decision to, you know what, this is a legitimate cause of action, let's pursue that because there's money there and that can help address the debts that are owed these creditors.
You're asking us not to speculate.
Well, no, I agree, and that is speculation. That's why the written disclosure rules exist, so we don't have to guess about those things. If it had been disclosed, there would be no guessing. The trustee would have addressed it, the creditors would have addressed it, and we wouldn't be here today because they would have either rejected and abandoned it, or they would have said, let's pursue that, and not dismissed his bankruptcy. One of the elements of non-disclosure, the trustee has the ability to convert a Chapter 13 to a Chapter 7 for purposes of when there's non-disclosure. He has that ability, and non-disclosure is one of those things. So,
Mr. Wilson?
Yes, sir.
Is it an undisputed fact that Mrs. Revel talked to the trustee and told the trustee that her husband had been injured?
It is undisputed insofar as that is the summary judgment evidence. as to what those discussions were, the content of it.
I'm sorry, you're talking about what's undisputed. I'm just asking you, did you dispute the fact that where there's a contention on the part of the Rebels that Ms. Rebel talked to the trustee and said, my husband has been injured?
No, sir. It's undisputed only because we could not dispute her self-serving affidavit.
Well, you could have...
Excuse me.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
What benefit accrued to the Rebels from the filing of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy?
They availed themselves of the protection of the bankruptcy code. It is fortuitous that this action happened and it got dismissed. They put themselves into the bankruptcy system and were bound by the rules that exist to all bankruptcy debtors.
So they got an automatic stay in terms of people trying that might be threatening to file or file lawsuits against them.
Yes, sir.
That's part of the bankruptcy you're talking about.
Yes, sir.
And what else?
Well, again, even in a broader sense, I mean, as a direct monetary benefit, that I can't answer. I do know that they were the beneficiary of an automatic stay. I don't know what benefit filing that bankruptcy did with respect to their creditors, because obviously they had the ability to come back and file another Chapter 13, and the filing of that bankruptcy may have caused their creditors to say, now, wait a minute, these folks are going to go away on us. Let's work out a deal. We don't know that. And had they disclosed it, we wouldn't have to be guess about that.
And in fact, there's no evidence that there was any person that had a claim who didn't have the same claim once it was dismissed, in light of the bankruptcy provision that places everyone back in the posture they were in before the filing of the Chapter 13 petition.
Well, Judge, I would respectfully disagree with that.
Well, tell me why. I'm learning
this court
about bankruptcy, and I'd like to know.
This court in Kilpatrick held that under Section 349, a non-disclosed asset, when the case is dismissed, does not go back to the debtor's estate.
All right.
It stays with the bankruptcy estate.
All right. So in terms of when the case reverts under 349, and when there is an actual dismissal of the case, and when there is no discharge of any creditor's rights to pursue a claim, I don't see how there's a benefit other than a delay in time of the legal process, other than in the bankruptcy court, in terms of benefit to the Rebels.
With all due respect, Judge, those are judicial estoppel arguments. That's not legal standing. This is a fundamental jurisdictional subject matter jurisdiction issue before this court.
All right, so let me ask you a different way. Is there a distinction in the bankruptcy law between the disclosure of an injury and the disclosure of a cause of action for the injury?
Absolutely. One is an asset. The other is a fact. The fact of an injury means nothing. A cause of action is something that creditors can latch on to and seek money from and liquidate.
And therefore, if the Rebels knew they had an injury but didn't know they had a cause of action, those would be distinctly different things, wouldn't it?
If is true, but as this court has held in Horsley Lehman, when someone has enough information to suggest they might have a cause of action, that imposes a duty on them to disclose it regardless of whether or not they know the legal theory or claim that underlies it.
And in terms of the difference in the earlier case, the Kilpatrick case, and this case, when a person in Chapter 13 bankruptcy knows they have an injury and report the injury and then seek legal advice as to whether that injury might result in a recovery of money based on a cause of action, Isn't that a very distinctly different thing from what we had in the Kilpatrick case, where there were three bankruptcies filed, monies paid, and actually things happened for the benefit of the person filing the bankruptcy? Three bankruptcies filed.
Yes, just factually it is somewhat different, but the underlying principles that are the foundation of the bankruptcy laws remain the same. This plaintiff in this case knew enough that he felt he was hurt, had been injured, thought Morrison's supplier was responsible, and sought out an attorney and retained that attorney to pursue that claim. That is distinctly different in terms of facts than in Kilpatrick, but the underlying principle is they knew they had a potential cause of action. They don't have to know the details. They don't have to know the legal theory. They just have enough to suggest they might have a cause of action. And when you go seek out an attorney, that tells you you know enough.
And it's your position that our previous authority stands for the proposition that knowledge of a cause, knowledge of an injury equates to knowledge of a cause of action and imposes a requirement to formally file an amended schedule?
Not exactly. In this case, it's more than just knowledge of an injury. It is knowledge of an accident and an injury, feeling that someone else is responsible, and retaining a personal injury lawyer to pursue it. Very, very different. Well, factually, in this case, that's...
How much time did the personal injury lawyer have? Let's think about that a minute. 2 years to file a lawsuit?
Well, not only did you have a personal injury attorney, but they indicated that they told their bankruptcy attorney.
Right.
So they have... But they never followed the law. They never disclosed it to the creditors or to the bankruptcy court or to the trustee, for that matter. They said that they were in accident, were hurt, and couldn't pay their bills. Very different factual elements that we have here.
Well, you don't have, well, maybe you do. I haven't looked at that affidavit recently enough to remember what all was said in there by what the rebels contended they told the trustee, but they did tell him that he'd been injured and couldn't work and couldn't make payments under the Chapter 13. And beyond that, in terms of what you just said about, well, they told the trustee enough about the accident that it rises to the level of being the cause of action.
Well, it's not what they told the trustee; it's what they knew that caused them to go to a personal injury attorney. If we're basing it on what they told the trustee, again, you have to go down the road of speculation of what they actually said and what the trustee interpreted those facts to mean. You have to speculate about what the trustee then extrapolated those facts, and does that create a cause of action? And then again, you put the burden on the creditors and bankruptcy court to ask the trustee if there's anything outside of the sworn written disclosures that are required to see if there's something else out there.
Mr. Wilson, thank you very much for answering my questions. I appreciate your frankness.
Again, what we have is a scenario to where this plaintiff in a briefing says, who's prejudiced if this case goes forward? That's an easy question. The judicial system, and in particularly integrity of the bankruptcy system. She calls these mandatory disclosure rules technicalities. That is the path that you go down if you accept these equitable arguments in the face of clear, undeniable, black and white rules that exist for very fundamental reasons. Those disclosures support the very foundation of the bankruptcy system. The court in this case has already decided these issues, and I do think Kilpatrick is dispositive of this appeal. This plaintiff had no standing. It is a standing, not a judicial estoppel case. The judge was correct in granting summary judgment, and we would ask that this court affirm.
Let me ask one follow-up question to Justice Meyer's line. So at this point, or as soon as after dismissal as possible, so your position would be that really the trustee is the proper entity or party to pursue the claim?
The bankruptcy estate.
The bankruptcy estate. And so should someone want to pursue it, that's the proper party. And they would have to then reopen the bankruptcy?
As this court said in Kilpatrick, that's the option that this plaintiff chose not to pursue. You go back to the bankruptcy court. You reopen it. You disclose this in schedules and allow the trustee to make an informed decision about what to do. Yes, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Austin.
Okay. Just a few points here. There was no any indication that there was money to be obtained as a result of the injuries. It could just have been to pay the medical bills. It could have been something else. There could have been no insurance. There are so many unknowns. That information came 14 months later, after the injury attorney that they went to developed the case and the cause of action. What happened was the appellant and his wife felt wronged by the appellee, and they just went to an attorney to find out if there was something they could do. They had no idea that there was something they could do. And that attorney said, well, I'll take it under investigation, and that information is in the affidavits. Next, the creditors had already objected and didn't want the confirmation of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy. The creditors objected to the amount they were going to receive. They wanted more. Converting to a Chapter 7 wouldn't have given them any more. Maybe including an injury that had no value attached to it at that point would not have changed the creditors' minds. Kilpatrick was decided before Ferguson, and specifically in Ferguson, it says, even assuming the existence of an inconsistent position, because this one is on judicial estoppel, but it does kind of flow to where we're at today, the Fergusons gained no advantage, and more importantly, neither building materials in the pending personal injury suit nor the creditors in the bankruptcy have suffered any disadvantage. And they allow that case to move forward. That is exactly what we're dealing with today. There was no disadvantage to any party unless you include the defendant in the underlying personal injury case who's supposed to pay for the negligence at the job that they have. Now, this court talks about not inadvertent. A debtor can establish inadvertence by showing that she did not know of a claim or had no motive to conceal the claim. So although this is judicial estoppel as well, you did contemplate at some point that as long as they didn't conceal something and no one was disadvantaged, there's a possibility you can move forward. And then in Norris, they reiterate that when you dismiss a case and there's no money paid to the creditors, there's no confirmation, it's void when you dismiss it. There's no more their actions. And there is nothing in the plain language of Section 349B3 that precludes assertion of the claim for lack of disclosure when the case is dismissed. So we're requesting that this court remand this case and allow the Revels to pursue the claim. There is no other party. Statute of limitations has passed, and the Revels deserve to be compensated for the injuries that they received.
So do you agree that the bankruptcy trustee could still, if the bankruptcy was reopened, could still file a cause of action based upon against Morrison?
Well, if a Chapter 13 bankruptcy has no confirmation plan, there are no benefits received to the debtors, the creditors aren't disadvantaged, then the bankruptcy is void.
So there's nothing to reopen?
I don't think there's anything to reopen. I mean, I think you can file. So right after Chapter 13 is dismissed for lack of payment and lack of confirmation, you can appeal that and reopen it then. There's a window to do that. In this case, I'm not sure if you can reopen that same bankruptcy. It's been several years now since that bankruptcy filed in 2012, and their entire financial situation has diminished and changed. So to go back to file that original bankruptcy, reopen that original bankruptcy would be, I'm not even sure if it's possible, and even then it would not look the same. It would be a completely different bankruptcy. So I don't think that the trustee is the appropriate party to go and pursue this claim.
All right, Ms. Austin, Mr. Wilson, we appreciate all your arguments and your briefing in connection with this matter. Your case is now submitted. That is the last case on our docket for this morning, so if the clerk will please adjourn court.
Honorable Court of Appeal.